Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. This episode is part of our summer 2023 special series, Read with Bruegel. In this series, we have the pleasure of hosting renowned authors who will discuss various economic issues based on their insightful books. We hope that this conversation will inspire you to explore their books and offer you some food for thought during your summer break. I am Nicolas Véran. Joining me today is Ulrich Binzahl, who works at the European Central Bank, but also has authored Central Banking Before 1800, A Rehabilitation. That book was published in 2019, just before the COVID-19 episode, but it's as relevant as ever because this is a history book. It's not in the immediate flow of news, and I think has very big questions for us right now. Ulrich, welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Yeah, thank you, Nicola. Thank you for having me.
So your book, Central Banking Before 1800, tells it on the tag, this is about financial history and the history of central banks. And indeed, you make this history start much earlier than some of the conventional wisdom has it. Can you give us a sense of that?
Yeah. I mean, the conventional wisdom, as you call it, typically sees central banking emerging in the 19th century, you know, links it to things like the upcoming banknote monopoly at the end of the century, or the lender of last resort function, which would have been discovered more or less by Bagehot or the 19th century Bank of England. But on all of those topics, you can, scratch the surface and discover that there was, a continuity, one could say, since the early 15th century, even with some early public banks, which offered giro functions and, do everything, I would say, that a modern central bank does, which emerged at that time and which had, with the Bank of Amsterdam, in the 17th century, a first sort of global leading central bank. And maybe one reason for why people ended up, just in the 19th century is also that they link central banking with banknotes. I mean, banknotes also start in the 17th century, but people see the real proliferation of banknotes, the emergence of banknotes covering really entire economies as a means of payment, that happened in the 19th century, and they associate central banking with banknotes.
Right, as most of us do, but maybe shouldn't do, right?
Yeah, there was the early public banks had ledgers, so they operated large balance sheets in ledgers. They recorded the payment of their depositors in ledgers. And that, brings us to the present or to the future of central banking, where maybe with CBDC, we are back to ledgers in terms of central bank money for all. So that is something one can...
Let's not jump to CBDC right away, but let's go to your story. The first central bank comes in Barcelona, actually. Was that a surprise?
Yeah, I mean, one has in mind maybe that banking comes from Italy, and therefore also early central banks are known, from Italy, from Venice, from Genoa. But I think strictly speaking, there was, there must have been a Mediterranean culture of traders, which was also present in early Catalonia. And Barcelona was, 4 years before Genoa in having something like a public giro bank, which was really used for giro payments.
So that's called the Taula de Canvi, and it appeared, according to the records, in 1401. And as you mentioned, a couple of years later, the Banco di San Giorgio in Genoa was created in 1407 or something. Is that really the beginning, or do you think we will, look through new archive and discover earlier central banks in the future?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think so. The literature I used exists for a while. Those public banks have been described for a while. There's, serious deep literature on them. I mean, not claiming that they were central bank, but describing them well, going to the archives, looking at their balance sheet. That has been done for almost, I would say, 100 years. So I wouldn't expect that we discover something completely new. Of course, the question could be what was there beforehand in terms of state paper money. You know, we know the Chinese history. They had state paper money, but there's a fundamental difference, namely the one of convertibility. No, I believe state paper money is anchored by the ability to pay taxes and maybe by the issuer imposing it as legal tender. But it's not, there's no convertibility promise. That's the difference. Though with central bank money before 1800, you could go and request that this is exchanged into precious metal. Everything referred to convertibility promise to precious metal. No.
So you define central bank money indeed as financial money. You define the central bank as the issuer of the highest quality financial money. So let's spend a few minutes on this, because there's a lot to unpack. How do you define financial money? Why not just money?
Well, financial money is money in the form of a claim towards someone. And that's, the alternative is commodity money, or, you know, you could say Bitcoin, if you like Bitcoin and can imagine it as a means of payment. So something that is not the liability of someone. And therefore, if I hold it, it's not a financial claim on someone. So financial money is when you have a claim, and central bank money is exactly that. It's issued by someone and you have a claim.
So just to understand, if I have a coin in my pocket, this is commodity money. It's not a claim on anybody else, or is it?
Well, today it's in fact a claim also more than a commodity, because it has no intrinsic value any longer. But in the past, that was a commodity, no?
So it's a gold. If it's a gold coin, it's commodity money.
Yeah.
If it's a current euro coin, it's financial money, just like a banknote.
I think so, yeah.
And Bitcoin would be like commodity money?
Yeah, like commodity money. I think I don't want to subscribe to the idea that Bitcoin is the gold of the 21st century, as some claim. But in terms of nature, it's like commodity money. Yeah.
This is because nobody has a liability for the Bitcoin, right? It's not a claim on anybody. It's just an object that I happen to own, correct?
Exact. Yeah, exact.
But if I own a gold coin, I at least believe I can exchange it for something. Anyway, let's not go into Bitcoin, but let's go back to this idea of the financial money of the highest quality. So that's the difference with Chinese paper money, right? Chinese paper money is also financial money. It's also a claim on somebody. That's the imperial government of China during the Yuan dynasty or something. But it's not of the highest quality because the imperial government has an incentive to debase it, correct?
Yeah, at least it is not convertible. I mean, the highest quality, I mean, you could preserve its purchasing power if you don't issue too much of it. I mean, but the central bank, the early central banks, anchored the value with a convertibility promise that you could check every day at the counter. No, there were episodes where this convertibility promise was lifted, but let's say the more lasting and better central banks could eventually, you know, have very long periods where convertibility was there most of the time, you know, except for short periods of maybe financial turmoil. But the Amsterdam and the Bank of Hamburg, I think they had centuries of convertibility.
Right. The Bank of Hamburg, you've studied in some detail. I think you even translated their founding statute. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was fun, of course. The language is a bit different. I mean, French, or I don't know English, but French from the early 17th century is quite readable. The German language was quite strange, you know. It was fun.
So you did the linguistics as well as financial history. But when you look at the substance of what was written there, do you feel that the statute of the Hamburger Bank, we're talking, 16, 19 or something. So early 17th century. What are the similarities and what are the differences with, you know, the way we draft legal texts that relate to central banks now?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was impressed by the similarities when I discovered those texts. So there's typically a preamble with a policy objective, though, why this thing is being set up. And it refers to things like, you know, means of payment. And the in the case of the Hamburger Bank, which also had a lending bank, it also refers to things we would, you know, associate with the lender of last resort. So preamble, and then, you know, a number of articles, which is structured not too different, in my view, from modern central bank mandates, where the different, you know, types of activities of the central bank are described in some detail. Then also very technical things like, you know, when is the counter opening, until what time can you make a transfer order, what type of piece of paper do you have to fill in, what happens if you are sick at home, can you send you know, someone on your behalf. All sorts of practical things are there, and I think that's the specific thing in central banks also compared to any other bank. It's the basis on legislation, so the basis on rules which are enshrined in primary legislation or then secondary legislation, while, you know, a bank has no, you know, a private bank or a banker, a merchant who does some banking business will not have written down, you know, a sort of constitution, a mandate, rules and procedures. So that's also something that, you know, tells us that there's a continuity, in my view, of those early, even 15th century public endeavors to up to today, the modern central bank, who are all based on such texts, really.
That's really interesting. So let's go back to this distinction now between central banks and other banks. So what you're suggesting is that if we think of the medieval bankers of the, you know, the Bardi, Peruzzi, Medici, the Fugger, all these guys, they were commercial entities. They weren't established by any public mandate. And that's a fundamental distinction with what you call the early central banks. But if we think of more recent banking history, banks are licensed or they're chartered. So what's the difference between a banking license in the modern sense and the public statute, the public mandates that you describe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the licensed bank is a bank that fulfills requirements that were established by the legislator or the regulator, no? And so the regulator supervisor ticks the boxes and says, okay, all requirements fulfilled, you get the license under this regime. And there are several ones, of course, who can get it. While the early public bank, there was a legislation establishing one of its sort, giving its unique privileges, like, for example, the exclusive right and obligation to merchants to settle bills of exchange above a certain size in the central bank, in the public bank. Yeah, so they got a unique status in you know, various aspects, and so it's not, you know, there is a set of rules to apply to banks, and they can apply, they get licensed, but they have a unique. There will only be one, you know, it's really one established by law.
So these early central banks are territorial monopolies, right? Like modern central banks are. So there's only one in a given place.
Yeah. Whereby they were all in, you know, republics, kind of merchant republics, no, the early ones.
Exactly.
Yeah. They were before banknotes were invented, no? And therefore, their technology was somewhat limited. You had to go to the counter to make your transfer order, no? And that was a revolution that banknotes brought, and therefore banknotes are associated to the national territorial expansion of central banking to nation states, like the United Kingdom with its colonial empire, or France, you know.
But when the first banknote, is it preserved?
I'm not sure it's the very first one, but it's those of the first years of the Riksen Standard Bank. The Stockholm Banko, the private. I mean, before Riksen Standard Banks who become.
So when was that?
That was in 1658. That this private endeavor called Stockholm Banko. I think the king was given one half of the equity to incentivize the king, you know, to support this project. But it was a private endeavor. I mean, the founder of it, a guy called Palmstoch, had promised a lot of policy benefits to the king also. So that was a guy who had spent time in Amsterdam, who knew the Bank of Amsterdam. So he really explained to the king at that time what this would bring in terms of commerce and also income to the state. And then this was launched, and the guy had the idea to issue banknotes. And, you know, this worked so well, but was not so well understood in terms of financial stability issues it would raise, that it was quickly, you know, run against the wall. And I think after 2 or 3 years of circulation, there was over issuance, there was over credit provided to the economy. And then there was, you know, a sort of run on the central bank, and convertibility had to be discontinued. There was a national financial crisis.
In Sweden?
In Sweden.
So we're talking about Sweden in the 1650s or 60s, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think it hit the wall in 1662 or something, yeah.
So this is a very interesting kind of historical arc in your narrative of the early central banks, right? Central banks start in Europe. They start in city-states and municipal republics, or equivalent of that, Barcelona was very autonomous from the Crown of Aragon, right? So it was basically a self-government situation at the municipal level, merchant republics, same in Genoa, then in Venice, then in Amsterdam, then in Hamburg, also an attempt in Nuremberg. And these were free cities, basically, governed by local oligarchy. And they were able to establish a credible central bank because of this republican government, right? The checks and balances that came with this early republican government made it possible to render the promise of convertibility and therefore of good quality money credible. And then we see in the 17th century, after the middle of the century, we see those new forms of central banks. You mentioned Johann Palmstoch in Stockholm, and then later in the century, the Bank of England. So they expand into states, right? They become, unlike their predecessors, they're basically private sector entities. So this is what holds the promise of independence and financial discipline and convertibility. So now the independence goes from municipal government to private sector, with some exceptions. There is a case of Vienna that you mentioned. And those private entities with a state charter, they expand the central bank function to the scale of an entire territorial state, right? And then that expands into 18th century with some bumps to other states like Spain, France, Austria to an extent. Do I get the kind of big narrative right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, there was always this topic which was discussed for a long time, and Montesquieu also mentions it in L'Esprit des Lois in 1748, that, you know, a monarch cannot work, you know, with a bank. And if he says bank, he means central bank. So he says on one side you have power, on the other side you have money. That doesn't work, because a prince, when being in trouble, will just grab, you know, the treasure of the bank. And so that was a bit the thinking. And in Sweden, I mean, the quick end of the Stockholm Banko was not, one must say, because the king grabbed the treasure, but because it worked too well. You know, this innovation of banknotes was just overwhelmingly successful.
So it was teasing trouble of a new model, right?
Yeah, exactly, of the banknote model. But then what happens in Sweden first was that, you know, what was created then as a successor institute was this Riksdagens Standardbank, which reported to the Stände, so to the parliament, if you want, and not to the king. So there was this challenge already at that time to find a construct to protect the bank from the king, which was not very successful in Sweden. I mean, Sweden has no glorious central bank history after this short episode. So banknotes are only being issued again in the 18th century, and then it's one of the more inflationary countries where convertibility is suspended for long periods of time. Yeah, so it's not an example to show that it works well in a monarchy. That was more indeed the Bank of England, which fell back to this construct of a private equity based firm, where I think the trick was. I mean, first, you were in a constitutional monarchy, so the king was somehow constrained anyway. Second, the ownership of the Bank of England was widespread amongst the elite, let's say. There was a maximum concentration. You could only hold a number of shares as individual, ensuring that there was it was not concentrated. So many of the wealthier citizens had those stocks and had an interest in this being preserved and not being taken by the government. And then there was also this special construct of combining it with a big loan. No, so there was this, the Bank of England balance sheet initially had this huge long-term loan to the government, which was part of the package and which somehow did the trick to make this a stable construct, which was respected then ever since by the government and could remain stable and then build up this reputation and scale and became the leading central bank in the 18th century.
So basically, the story is that central banks are really advantageous, right? You have high quality money. This is good for economic development. Difficult to get the causation completely right, but basically we're talking about big economic success stories here. You know, Venice in the Renaissance, Amsterdam in the 17th century, the Golden Age, and so on and so forth. So in a way, why did it take so long for everybody to adopt that machinery? Right, because there were still a number of important countries without a central bank. As late as the end of your period in 1800, not every significant country, even just in Europe, had a central bank. Why was it so difficult?
Mm-hmm. Why did it not spread faster? I think for a surface economy, you need banknotes, no? And banknotes, that was a bumpy start and got quite a bad reputation. I mean, there was the Swedish example, then there was the French example. No, the Banque Générale was fine. I think it was a serious construction, worked very well for 2 years.
That was John Law in the late 1710s, right?
1716, exactly. I think Banque Générale was established. It worked perfectly fine. Then, you know, there were the big ideas of first it was made public. No, it became Banque Royale. The king got all the shares, and then there were, you know, two ambitious constructions to refinance the entire public debt and so on. It was a bit a repetition, I would say, of Sweden in the sense of completely, you know, riding the success of banknotes to make it unsustainable and then have a big disaster. And so, at least for France, you know, it was another trauma which lasted then many decades before the next attempt was made, and it had to be called, you know, the Caisse des Comptes. Couldn't be called a bank because memory was so bad. So some just mismanaged it, no? And in, Germany, okay, the first Friedrich der Große, created this Prussian Royal Bank, but designed it poorly. It was also, he had ideas which the merchants were not convinced. It went over years. I think, yeah, it was just the monarch who was, I think, over-engineering this. Then you had the Napoleonic War. So, yeah, quickly you are in the 19th century. And then things things, you know, I think are really spreading. And then this model of the Bank of England prevails and everybody copies this construct and it works fine. You know, there are emerging best practices. And as you say, there was only one who did not follow this example in the 19th century, the private construct of banking. You know, that was the Bank of Russia, actually. They always stayed.
And look what happened.
Yeah, look what happened.
So the Bank of Russia was public when in the late 19th century, when all its peer group of central bank in Western European or Central European countries were owned by private shareholders under a public charter or legislation, correct?
Exactly, yeah.
And then in the 20th century, but that's not your book, the model of a nationalized or public sector central bank took over. Because in a way, you could say is that the states became more disciplined in a way, that they became able to live with the banks they would control in theory, but leave independent in practice. Is that the right way to put it?
Yeah, I mean, there was, I think the nationalization of central banks, came after the war, really. Because people, I mean, I don't know what the new role model was, and it's not even complete, you know, in the
maybe it's the Federal Reserve, right? The Federal Reserve was public from...
Yeah, not really. You know, that's a very special construct, no? Where you have the Board of Governors, who is clearly, a public board, but the Federal Reserve Bank's not so clear what they are. No, they're not really public either. But we still have, you know, in the euro area, in the euro system, a mixture of banks which have private shareholders and some who have not, no? So I think Banca d'Italia...
That's right. In Italy, in Belgium.
Yeah. But okay, they're heavily subject to the policy mandate. No, there's no real decision making of the shareholder any longer. And maybe that was already emerging even in the 19th century, that the predominance of policy objectives is at the end making a private construct obsolete once you have, I would say, a very stable state and the rule of the law, and you don't have any longer a prince, you know, who will grab the treasure of the central bank. That was no longer a topic, no, in the 20th century. There the topic was it...
Still happens from time to time?
But in different forms, you know, you inflate the currency. It's a variant of it, indeed.
Okay, I'm not going to talk about Lebanon here. I want to go take a step back and, in a way, ask you why you wrote this book. What drove you to go into this immense amount of very erudite work? You're a central banker, you're a practitioner of central banking, you've led operations and financial infrastructure at the European Central Bank, you're in charge of the Digital Euro Project now. So how do you connect this very nerdy, wonkish history pre-1800 to your job and to the debates as a contemporary central banker, especially in the Eurozone? And indeed, the book goes a little bit into this as well, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it must be my own tendency to drift towards also historical topics. I mean, I did it already at my PhD, which was more on vertical integration and property rights and asset specificity. But then I ended up with a case study on vertical integration of stock exchanges in the 19th century. And then I even wrote a paper. I had to find it again, but it is on the vertical integration in markets of medieval towns from the 8th to the 12th century. So the same happened to me when I was in a central banker that I entered in historical topics. And, you know, at some stage, I just, I was a bit interested in it. But there are quite some superficial, account summaries of what the origins of central bank are. And then at some stage, I discovered this paper by Roberts and Felde on early public bank, the 2014 paper, which is very clear. You know, there's a big difference of this paper towards, you know, the normal economist account of the origins of central banking. And then I got into the topic, and the paper of Roberts and Velde, which I really recommend to everyone, is very humble. You know, it doesn't say and here we rewrite the history of central banking. It just describes those early public banks. And I think I took it a bit as a starting point, but then, you know, was more excited on making the point that those were really central banks, that there's this continuity of history of central banking. And that excited me enough, you know, to do the work of then writing this book.
So in a way, the conventional wisdom you go against is very, illustrious. You mentioned, I don't want to get too focused on names, but you mentioned Charles Goodhart, Gary Gorton, a number of luminaries of the economic profession who propagate this narrative that basically the Swedes started it and then the English with the Bank of England, and that was the birth of central banking. So what kind of pushback have you gotten from them? I mean, do they now agree with you that this view was wrong and too limited, and that central banking actually started in continental Europe, or do they still disagree?
No, I mean, Charles Goodhart was very nice. I mean, I talked with him on that, and he was not defensive. I mean, he seemed to agree. I mean, he was very kind. I mean, talking about him, you know, there's this tricentenary volume for the Bank of England, which was published indeed in 1994, and there's a 200 pages chapter on the evolution of central banking, and that was, you know, when you see this, what I found shocking as a practical central banker is that you could write 200 pages on central bank history without showing one central bank balance sheet. You see, I mean, me as a practical central banker, everything I did relates somehow to the central bank balance sheet. No, whatever you do, banking business, you know, affects your balance sheet. So it was...
It's all about the assets and the liabilities.
Exactly. I mean, you issue currency, you have to, you know, hold some assets, you give credit to banks, you can buy securities. Whatever you do, also monetary policy is not... there's no such thing as open mouth policy that some economists imagined. It all has to be, you know, open mouth policy is just expectation or announcements made on real policies which affect the financial market and the balance sheet. So it was a big surprise to see that people can write 200 pages on the evolution of central banking without showing a single balance sheet. And that cannot be. So I was convinced that there was some problem.
Take that, Bank of England. By contrast, your book has a lot of balance sheet information, and it's actually quite extraordinary to see the granularity that you achieve in comparing and documenting the balance sheets of those banks in the 17th century or even before. How did you achieve that? How was it possible to get all that balance sheet information? Is that an existing literature? Did you have to do archival work? Can you get us more of a sense of that?
Yeah, I have to confess, I did not do any archival work. I found all of this in literature. So, yeah, there were people who had looked closely at those banks who had done this tremendous work of going into the ledgers and writing down positions by positions. You just have to find it. And I didn't go beyond what I found. There are some central banks who also put their whole balance sheet history in the internet. So the Bank of England and the Riksbank show balance sheet data from the first days of existence, basically. And I use that data, while in other cases, I remember I really typed in my holidays from books of authors who had copied this and had shown it, you know, big lists in books like Van Dillen on the Bank of Amsterdam. I typed this in my holidays and enjoyed this somehow.
Yeah, that's a good holiday activity. What's fascinating is that basically all these early central banks have the same liability business, which is issuing money. But they don't have the same asset structure at all. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, one big debate was to what extent can you diversify your asset side beyond your precious metal reserve? No, because central banking or banking becomes interesting if you can diversify your asset side. You can generate income. or you can even pursue policy objectives different from the issuance of means of payment, like being a lender of last resort and so on. But at that time, the convertibility promise was crucial. And insofar, any central bank, you could say even until the end of Bretton Woods, was in a certain way subject to a liquidity constraint. After Bretton Woods, it's no longer the case. But so those, if you look then at this diversity of...
Because of the anchoring of the system in gold, right? Or in precious metal more generally.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, everybody, you know, had this in mind, you know, this anchor. And this was, if you want, also the definition of price stability. There was not price stability beyond maintaining this convertibility promise. So, I mean, what was the end result? There was quite some heterogeneity, first of all, in the precious metal reserve relative to the money issued. And I mean, in my book, in the period 1700 to 1770, the Bank of Amsterdam, for example, had 83% coverage ratio, Hamburger Bank 67%, Bank of England 34%, the Riksbanken, the Swedish 12%, in parentheses, and most of the time did not preserve convertibility. And the Naples banking system also had a 71%. So you see, I mean, maybe the summary is between 50% and or above 50%, you can maintain convertibility. Maybe that would be the conclusion. And then what did they have on their asset side if it wasn't precious metal? I mean, the Bank of England was very special. There was a government exposure of 78% of the total balance sheet, which was, however, mostly not matched on the liability side with means of payment, but with equity. So that was a unique construct. For the others, the government exposure, again, you know, for the period I mentioned, was between 5% Bank of Amsterdam, 38% the Swedes. And then you had a loan to private entities between 0% Bank of England, according to the statistics. I'm not sure it's rightly interpreted. But you had in Hamburg 21% and in Sweden 26% of the total balance sheet was in the form of credit to the private economy. And discounting bills was in the third item, which was, however, quite low at this time. That became in the 19th century the key financial asset of central banks, no discounting, but not yet in the 18th century.
So what's the difference between discounting bills and lending to the private sector, the kind of collateralized lending or Lombard lending that central banks do?
Yeah, I mean, you give a loan, Lombard lending loans. So that's, you give a loan and you get collateral for it. But the loan is really to one party, and it's, you know, the duration can be 3 months, 6 months. The very short duration we have today was not yet known or not standard. While discounting is you buy bills of exchange before maturity, and a bill of exchange, I won't start, I mean, not going too much into detail, but that was basically a mixture of a credit instrument and could be an exchange, foreign exchange settlement instrument. And that had different signatures, so the credit quality was supposed to be very high. It had a residual maturity of 3 months. The central bank bought it before maturity, and it was then settled in the accounts of the central bank. And that became, I think, the biggest standard central bank asset in the 19th century. And central banks believed that this is, you know, the sound central bank asset. There was a real bills doctrine, though, which was saying those should be real bills based on real commercial, you know, transactions and not financial bills, which are just created for the sake of maybe being discounted with the central bank.
So what would be the equivalent today? Is that money market intervention, or has that disappeared basically from central bank practice?
Yeah, I think it has disappeared. We don't have discounting any longer. now, you know, the central bank before 2007, what we still believe was maybe the normal state of central banking in the 21st century. There we had, you know, I don't know, we had a few hundred billion euro as euro system of central bank credit. So, you know, credit to banks with a maturity mainly of 2 weeks, collateralized by a pool of collateral. That's today maybe the standard operation.
I'm getting a bit sidetracked, but it's fascinating. This is the whole thing of the whole book, right? I mean, as a practitioner, you make this very old past feel relevant and comparable to what's happening today. And indeed, in your concluding chapter, you compare 15 different, we're not going through all of them, but 15 different kinds of challenges in terms of independence, communication, transparency, governance, etc., between these early central banks and particularly the Eurozone now and a bit Germany, which I found completely fascinating and indeed highlighting the similarities. One thing that has evolved over time is senior age, right? Because it used to be perhaps even more prominent than it is now. Has there been competition between governments and early central banks for the income of senior age? How was that framed?
Yeah, there may have been a few decades where this was a competition. I think the Prussians, for example, they had for some decades more, you know, state paper money, Kassenscheine, as they were called, than central bank banknotes. And I read there were negotiations between the central bank and the government, basically, on the central bank not issuing more banknotes for that reason. But in other places, I don't think it played such a role. So at the end, if the government can ensure that the central bank shares its profits with the government, which was the case, I believe, then all is fine. No, the income at the end ends with the government. No, I think it was a debate, you know, with the Bank of England, whether the shareholders, you know, got too much of from the cake. And Ricardo, I think David Ricardo's last work was about the nationalization of the Bank of England, and he advocated it also from the perspective of economizing on seniorage and not sharing this with private shareholders.
Another debate which is very topical now is the so-called separation debate. So the central banks have a mandate for price stability, but also financial stability. That's a question of banking supervision, right? We see it kind of removed from the People's Bank of China, but brought back into the fold in recent years with the ECB, the Bank of England. We'll see what happens with the Federal Reserve if they end up having more problems with supervision that emerged in the spring, but let's hope that's not the case. So what would be the equivalent in the ancient times that you look at in your book, and is there any, you know, lesson from that long history about the separation debate, whether financial supervision is connected with central banking or not?
Mm-hmm. I mean, separation principle, one would be to separate, let's say, the macroprudential financial stability or to combine the two and the monetary policy. And again, before 1800, even afterwards, convertibility, you know, or preserving convertibility was monetary policy, the equivalent of what is today monetary policy. And you had episodes of financial crisis where there was a conflict between the two. And there is, you know, the biggest, maybe best documented episode of financial stability in the 18th century was a crisis of in the 1760s, where you can compare how the central banks of Hamburg, Amsterdam, and the Bank of England reacted to a European financial crisis, one can really say. And there, at that moment, the Hamburger Bank and the Bank of Amsterdam had credibility. So you could see that their balance sheet expanded, but they did not lose a precious metal reserve. So, you know, the traders who were, let's say, in surplus liquidity, were happy to deposit their surplus with the central banks, while the traders who were in trouble got, at least in Hamburg, special Lombard loans, you know. And that worked for Hamburg because, yeah, Hamburger Bank seemed to have had credibility in that year, while the Bank of England also was lending but lost 90% of its precious metal reserve because, I mean, the interpretation I would give is that the traders did not want to leave their money there if not needed, but preferred to hoard it themselves. And I mean, that shows as long as the central bank had total credibility, it could combine convertibility and the lender of last resort function. But if it didn't have, then it was had the same problems as a private bank under a bank run itself. And it had a conflict of interest of between the two objectives, no? And then talking about banking supervision, so microprudential, I think one can trace back to also, for example, the Hamburger Bank and its lending arm. There's an idea that it would give credit to support sound citizens. They use a word like this, solid or sound citizens. So there's already the perception that you have to give credit only to, you know, just sound balance sheet where you don't have excessive credit risks or people who behave well. And you could say that is the sort of starting point of supervision also. In the 19th century, so that's not in my book, but I learned it recently, there were quite some central banks who limited the credit they provided to banks depending on the, again, if you want, rating of the bank, which also provided incentives and, you know, initiated a process where the central bank looks at the financial soundness of the banks who can potentially get credit.
Where did that happen in the 19th century? Any country examples?
Yeah, that was, I mean, I learned it in a conference a few weeks ago in Österreich, Österreich-Ungarn.
In Austria-Hungary, yeah.
Exactly, sorry, yeah, indeed. And so there's a paper on this that I can dig out of.
Okay, so that was the Austrian-Hungarian bank, presumably after 1878, if my memory is correct. Yeah. Anyway, now you work on central bank digital currencies and the digital euros. So in a way, the book provides a kind of echo of that because you go against technological fetishism, right? You say central banks didn't start with banknotes. They're not going to end with banknotes. That still begs the question, are new technologies changing the essence of finance and or of central banking in a different manner from earlier episodes now? Or is that just more of the same and, you know, central banking will remain the same kind of business as it has ever been since that Barcelona Taula de Canvi in 1401?
Yeah, I think the essence of central banking is the same, but you have to study carefully what difference it makes. And, you know, the episodes of Stockholm Banco and the Banque Royale illustrate that new technology can, you know, overwhelm you in its success and potential. And I think that's a lesson that central banks have learned. And there's a lot of careful study, maybe even excessive concerns on central bank digital currency, that it could, you know, also be such a success that there would be excessive inflows which would disintermediate the banks. And if you have followed the legislation of the commission that came out 2 weeks ago on digital euro, it prescribes the setting of limits to prevent that. So lessons learned, maybe. If you change the form of central bank money, be careful on financial stability implications. Otherwise, absolutely, you know, why banknotes, I'm making this when I talk about CBDC, you know, people tell me, why do you want to do that? People who don't like the idea of CBDC. And then I tend to answer, why should the central bank, I mean, be the only one sticking forever with 17th century technology? Everything has moved away from paper. All financial instruments, which maybe were in the 19th century or beyond on paper, have disappeared. Okay, banknotes have some still, you know, some nice properties in terms of privacy and resilience against the cyber and everything that is IT disruption, of course. So central banks continue to like them also because it's the exclusive baby of the central bank. Of course, therefore, central banks like it. But otherwise, banknotes have lost, of course, their one important unique property that they can solve the problem of space, no, of surface. Today, you are almost everywhere online. And therefore, you know, the problem that constrained giro banking in the public giro banking in the 15th century to remain something for merchant republics, that no longer exists. You can have a central ledger and with online use it everywhere. So that comparative advantage of banknotes, which made it such a great addition to the economy for many centuries, is no longer really there. And yeah, in this way, you can link, you know, the future with the past. Yeah.
Only to the extent that the internet is really universal, because if I'm in China and I don't have a Chinese account, I would like to be able to use my banknotes, but that's no longer possible.
Exactly.
Anyway, we could continue for hours. This is so fascinating, certainly for a history freak like me, but I think to many others among us. Thanks a lot, Ulrich Binzail. I say it again, the book is Central Banking Before 1800, A Rehabilitation at Oxford University Press, published in 2019, but ever relevant since. Thanks a lot for tuning in to The Sound of Economics. That's to the audience. You can read all our analysis by Bruegel scholars on the website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks again, Ulrich. Thanks a lot to everybody for joining The Sound of Economics. And until next time, bye-bye.